Brian McClanahan Show, episode 254.
It's time to think locally and act locally. Welcome to the Brian McClanahan Show.
Back to the Brian McClanahan Show. Glad to have you back on the program. Very glad to be here. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter at Brian McClanahan. Like my Facebook page at Brian McClanahan. And of course, subscribe to my YouTube page where you can watch this podcast at Brian McClanahan. If you don't want to search for all those social media accounts, just go to my webpage, brianmcclanahan.com. That's B-R-I-O-N, McClanahan.com. At the top of the page, you'll find all my social media buttons. And while you're there, give me an email address and I will give you a free ebook, Forgotten Founders, and a free audiobook of the same title, read by yours truly. You can support the Brian McClanahan Show while you're there by going to brianmcclanahan.com/support or just click on that support tab at the top of the page. You can throw a few pennies my way, help keep the lights on, help keep the podcast going. You can also buy your book plate. If you want my autograph on one of my books, just get that book plate. I'll autograph it, send it out to you. The best way to support the Brian McClanahan Show, though, is by going to McClanahanAcademy.com. That's McClanahanAcademy.com. It's always free to enroll. You get a free class when you do enroll, so check your email. You get a link to it. But I do have 7 classes available for purchase there. A lot of great stuff. I've got classes on the Declaration, one on Secession, one on the War, one on Reconstruction, one on Alexander Hamilton, and my latest is United States History 2, 1865. It is a comprehensive course, 54 lectures. You can use it as a standalone homeschool curriculum, or you can use it as a lifelong learner. Either way, it's a great course. Part 2 will be coming in the fall, so you're going to want to be looking out for that. And those that do enroll in McClanahan Academy do get the best deals on forthcoming courses, without a doubt. You get the best deals. So you want to be enrolled, even if you haven't purchased anything yet, you still want to be enrolled. But that's a great way to support the show. You can also get all your Brian McClanahan Show gear at redbubble.com. Just go to my webpage, brianmcclanahan.com. Click on that shop tab, take you right out to Redbubble where all my stuff is, right? You've got my logo on all kinds of things, not just t-shirts, but also coffee mugs and skins for your electronic devices, lots of cool stuff. And you can always go to LearnTrue, T-R-U-E, history.com, LearnTrueHistory.com. It's my affiliate link for Tom Woods Liberty Classroom where I do teach there as well with a lot of great people, Tom Woods, Kevin Goodsman, Brad Berzer, Jason Jewell, Bob Murphy, and a host of others. And it's not just history, it's economics, philosophy, a lot of good stuff. So it's a great website, a lot of bang for your buck, over 20 classes. I think Deborah Berzer teaches, Brad Berzer's wife teaches there now. So a lot of great stuff there. You're going to want to do that too. All right, listener-generated episode. I probably got about 10 to 20 emails about this particular piece. So people wanted to hear about it, so I'll talk about it. It's the piece that appeared in The Federalist entitled The Ghost of John C. Calhoun Haunts Today's American Left. And it is an interesting piece. Now, I've already commented on, I think it's John Davison or John, yeah, it's John Davison, I think his name is there at The Federalist. I've already commented on some of the things he's written before. And he's a Straussian. He's a Jaffaite Straussian. He says some things that are right. Look, I mean, even the Jaffaites don't like the way that the modern historical profession is going, and for good reason. But the problem is they don't realize that they're actually contributing to it by some of the things that they say. They validate in certain areas this SJW, social justice warrior, interpretation of American history. And so this piece has to do with this New York Times 1619 project. Now, a lot of people have asked me to comment on that particular project, quote-unquote historical project, as well. Here's the deal with that. I'm going to talk about it this one time in this one podcast because, in my opinion, simply by talking about it or writing articles about it, you're validating the stupidity of it. Nobody should read this thing. Nobody should pay it any attention. Everyone should just ignore it. And you should ignore it because when you pay attention to it and you talk about it, you somehow give it credence that it's somehow intellectually viable, which it is not. There's nothing about it that in any way enhances our discussion of American history. It is a myopic view of America based on the fact that these people that are writing in this think that everything comes down to two issues in America, race and slavery. And it's simply not true. And we know it's not true. But regardless, they want to make it that way. They also forget some inconvenient information that would destroy this entire idea that somehow the United States was really founded in 1619. And that's that African slaves were here long before that with the Spanish. The Africans that were brought in 1619 were not chattel slavery, as they would like to say. They do say that. They were not chattel slaves. They were indentured servants and treated as such for 20 to 40 years afterwards. In Virginia, the first instance of lifelong bondage was actually an African enslaving another African. And it wasn't until the 1660s that you had any type of legal codification of quote-unquote chattel slavery. So all of the slaves brought in 1619 for the next 40 years in Virginia were not chattel slaves. They were indentured servants and treated that way. I wrote a little piece for the Abbeville Institute 2 weeks ago, I think it was now, on this inconvenient history of South Carolina as well, that slaves in South Carolina in the early 18th century, now we're into the 1700s, in the early 18th century were armed and were in the militia of South Carolina. Another inconvenient fact that the 1619 people would like to ignore. The other inconvenient fact, of course, is that Africans were responsible for the entire transatlantic slave trade, because without African involvement, it wouldn't have happened. The fact is, as Thornton has pointed out in a wonderful book on the African slave trade, and he wrote this thing, he said, look, my fear is that people are going to read this. What he was trying to do was actually say that his fear was that people would read it and say, well, I mean, this is all the fault of Africans. But he knew exactly what he was saying, because the conclusion of the book is that Africans dominated. They actually dictated the terms of the trade. They required the slaves for the trade. They did all of these things. And he actually wanted it to be a positive book, because what he's saying is that Africans just, they weren't victims with a capital V. They were actively engaged in this. And they were the ones who were trying to keep the trade going, because they were making a lot of money on it, while Europeans were trying to back out of it by the 18th century, 19th century in particular. But the 18th century, people were talking about ending the trade. While they were trying to do that, Africans are saying, no, you got to keep this thing going, because this is how we make all of our money. So it's a complex history, one that the 1619 Project does not simply ignore these things, or they just sweep them under, or they just don't talk about it, whatever it is, or they don't know. I don't know what the case is, but the 1619 Project, as John Daniel Davidson says, is garbage. It is. The problem with this particular piece, though, is that it gets into a narrative of Calhoun that's based on Jaffa's interpretation of Calhoun and the founding in particular. And just to give you an idea of what Jaffa thinks about the founding, it's the same thing that dominates generally the neoconservative position on the founding, and that is, we live in a proposition nation. So if you've ever heard that before, and it goes back to Lincoln. Jaffa was someone who was very much interested in Lincoln and thought that Lincoln was the continuation of the founder's ideals. And that's because of Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. Now, of course, at the same time you had in the North, you had people talking about that the Declaration was a founding document, that somehow that second paragraph of the Declaration, namely the first line of the second paragraph of the Declaration, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by the Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So that particular line set forth, as Lincoln says, a new nation, right? So this idea that we have that line determining the future of American history is a founding principle. Now, this leaves out what Jefferson meant by that line. It leaves out what that entire process looked like in the 18th century. Jefferson, of course, was not meaning that everyone under the sun was equal. In terms of outcome, situation, what he meant was that all citizens were equal under the law, because this goes back to the Magna Charta. And I think this has been proven conclusively by several individuals. And Jefferson himself said at one point that, look, we didn't mean anything revolutionary by this. This was simply an expression of the American mind, which if you go back and you look at the English Bill of Rights, again in 1688, you look at the Magna Charta, this is exactly what the English had said for the previous 500 years at that point, right? So this was not something that was base as a proposition. And when he says that you have life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, of course, that was lifted directly from George Mason's line in the Virginia Constitution, which talked about the fact that the Virginians had a right to life, liberty, and then pursuit of and property, which is the basis of happiness. And of course, that goes back to John Locke. And now we can get into Blackstone and the fact that Blackstone said that anyone sets foot on English soil is free. That would be something else that we're getting into legality there. But certainly Jefferson himself didn't think everyone was equal. He said as much in his notes on the state of Virginia. He was very critical of African Americans. So, and that's just a fact of history. It's not to say that he's right, but it's just what he was. So let's get into this piece because I want to focus on just a couple of issues in it, and we'll get into Calhoun and we'll get into the founding because he said some things that are curious in this particular piece. So, and again, I mean, look, there's a lot of common ground here, but the problem is by bashing Calhoun, you actually undermine your position. Because, and I'll bring up why near the end of this, and why conservatives and leftists should admire John C. Calhoun. John C. Calhoun should be admired across the board because of his concern with power, you see. And he says as much in his disquisition on government. That's one thing that we should be celebrating Calhoun for. And there's a couple other things in here that he makes it out like Calhoun was the first to say some of these things. So anyways, I'll get into all that. So his line, the 1619 Project is garbage history, true. And he has a link there. He says, there are sound historical reasons why 1619 isn't a helpful jumping off point. Yes, I mean, there's a link. It's a fantastic piece. It was written a couple of years ago. Also, Kevin Gutzman brought something up. 1619 is also the year that you had your first English Thanksgiving in North America. We know that they had one in Florida, the Spanish did, long before that. It was also the first year of an elected assembly in North America. And that's something to say that that's a real founding point. So if you want to say that, that's a real important point for the future of the United States. But no, it's about the fact that some people were brought in as indentured servants. We already had slavery in America before that. I mean, look, we had indentured servants who were Europeans. And we know there was a large white slave trade coming into places like Pennsylvania. So we already had indentured servitude. This was not the creation of slavery in America. And we know, again, there were Africans, there were Indians who were enslaved. So this is, again, a myopic, idiotic view of Americans' past. Now, he does say, for example, the essay that launches the project by Nicole Hannah Jones is premised on a series of false assertions about the American founding, including that the revolution was fought to protect slavery. Now, let me address that point for a second. This is what the British said. When you look at Virginia and New York, there were two Emancipation Proclamations there. The British said that the war was fought for slavery. So he's saying, no, you can't say that because these people weren't fighting for slavery. We know that Washington, for example, wanted all slaves that were captured by the British in New York to be returned, and the British refused. And he was hot about that. So was that war about slavery? The British certainly said it was. So when you look at that, and people, the neoconservatives, oh my gosh, how can they say this about the founders? Well, aren't you saying the exact same thing about the South in 1861? And Southerners would say, look, it's an issue. But why was it an issue? And how does it fit into the bigger picture here? I mean, Southerners were fighting for their independence in 1861, just like Americans at large were fighting for their independence from the British in 1776 or 1775 when the war begins. Is there no difference? But you have to bristle. Oh my gosh, you can't say this about these people because these are the founders. Well, every single one of the American states had slavery in 1776. There's not one that didn't. And we know that, of course, over time, slavery would end, and there were people that were opposed to the institution. There were also Southerners opposed to the institution, and there were Southerners even in 1860s that weren't necessarily in favor of the institution. It's amazing how they bristle at this when there is evidence that this is, it's not a false assertion. It's what the British said. So we can say that it's not true. We can say that, well, I mean, that's not necessarily accurate, 100% accurate. But if the British said it and there were two Emancipation Proclamations, well, is there not some justification for someone like Nicole Hannah-Jones saying these things? Well, certainly. There's nuance here. This is where history is shades of gray, not just black and white. And I think that's the problem. We don't get into the nuance anymore. That the British Empire was turning against slavery in the 18th century. Well, they were. I mean, look, the British Empire ended slavery before the United States. We know that in the late 18th century, there were discussions in Parliament about ending the slave trade in particular, but also slavery throughout the empire writ large. And that happened in 1806, 2 years before the United States ended the slave trade. So we know there were some serious discussions about this. She's not wrong about that. And that the American founders consciously disbelieved the ideas they espoused. Well, it depends on how you phrase it. So, I mean, look, I can actually give Nicole Hannah-Jones, I mean, some of the things she's saying here are accurate. Now, consciously disbelieved, it depends on how you use that word liberty. And there were some, of course, that would point out, well, I mean, you know, Jefferson's being inconsistent. Even at the time, how can you say these things when you are a slave owner? Well, because they understood the difference. They understood they were talking about citizens, freemen, and the rights of life, liberty, and property. And so that was not inconsistent to them. They didn't see the inconsistency there. Now, today we might say, well, they were inconsistent. But no, it was perfectly logical for them at the time. This is why presentism is such a dangerous thing. Historically speaking, there's no evidence for any of that. Of course there is. I just gave you some. She argues persuasively. No. See, this is where he gives her some credence for something that's not true while denying something that might be true. So persuasively, that African Americans are the true believers in America's founding ideals. I don't think she argues persuasively that at all. I mean, I would say Jefferson was a true believer in America's founding ideals, which was independence, number one, the most important thing, self-determination, which was America's founding ideals, and maintaining the Constitution that you're supposed to maintain, which was what the war was about in 1776. The British were violating the Constitution. I remember that I had a talk show host one time tell me, there was no British Constitution in 1776. There's no British Constitution today. There isn't. You mean the unwritten Constitution that's locked up there and in the Parliament, in the other tower opposite from Big Ben? You mean that Constitution, which is a whole bunch of scrolls sitting up there? That's the British Constitution. I mean, it's just not written down like ours is, but they have one. And the American colonists talked about it constantly. This is the violation of the Constitution. Perhaps the most disingenuous essay of the bunch is by Times opinion columnist Jamil Bowie, who argues that the debt ceiling crisis of 2011 and Senator Mitch McConnell's use of the filibuster can be traced directly back to the political philosophy of John C. Calhoun and the secessionists of the antebellum South. So, yeah, I mean, look, that's where the junk really hits. I mean, this is where the crap just falls out, right? This is presentism run amok. This is using history in a way that you can't use it. In any accurate way. And this is what the problem with the 1619 project is. It's not really a historical project. It's a leftist hit piece designed to denounce the right. It's not really a discussion of nuances of history or to try to bring the focus back to anything. It's to say, you know what, all these Donald Trump supporters are evil people because they believe in these things. And I remember there was actually an article about, I think it was in Slate, the reaction to the 1619 Project exposes the right for what they are. They're just a bunch of racists. And this is where the project was going. It was try to, in their mind, you know, smoke people out, right? Smoke them out. Come on, denounce the thing. If you denounce it, you're a racist. Well, if you say this project is stupid because the history is stupid and there's nothing to it, that's not being racist. It's saying your position is stupid, which it is. No, really. The election of Barack Obama, writes Bowie, wrought a fundamental change in the Republican Party, which committed itself to total opposition, not just blocking Obama, but also casting him as fundamentally illegitimate and un-American. He may have been elected by a majority of the voting public, but that majority didn't count. Really? This is interesting, because then he goes in, he's making fun of the Bowie piece. He says, who else didn't think the majority counted? Why? The Confederates. After all, the South seceded after Abraham Lincoln's victory in 1860, did not. Also, Calhoun laid the groundwork for secession years before with the doctrine of the concurrent majority, did he not? Therefore, McConnell blocked Obama's judicial nominees, or when Republican state legislatures changed state campaign finance laws, or when Republicans and only Republicans engaged in aggressively gerrymandering, they're obviously acting as inheritors and champions of Calhoun's racist secessionist political ideology. So this is Bowie arguing that, not Davidson. Now, Lincoln was not elected by a majority. I mean, Lincoln was elected by 39.6% of the voting population, which, of course, that doesn't even matter. What matters is the Electoral College. And so Obama did win legitimately in the Electoral College. Lincoln won legitimately in the Electoral College. But if you want to just say numbers, well, Lincoln didn't get the support of almost 61% of the American public. Donald Trump won legitimately in the Electoral College, yet people run around saying he didn't. Well, if he didn't, then Lincoln didn't win legitimately. Neither did a host of other presidents who didn't get 50% of the popular vote, yet won the Electoral College. This is how stupid their argument is. And Calhoun didn't lay the groundwork for secession at all. In fact, the people who laid the groundwork for secession were two Northerners, Rufus King and Oliver Ellsworth in 1794. That's what laid the groundwork for secession, because Northerners were talking about it long before the South even considered it. Secession was on the lips of every member of the founding generation, even before the Constitution was written. They talked about disunion. In fact, they said the Constitution will save America from disunion. What it did is sow the seeds of the ultimate disunion. They all knew that the Union was you know, on sandy ground. I mean, this thing was not necessarily going to work because you had incompatible things. In terms of economy, you had a North which was commercial and was moving towards industrialization by the early 19th century, and you had a South which was agrarian and was not moving towards industrialization. They had different views on the powers of the central government. These were problems that they were having trouble reconciling even in the Continental Congress. They couldn't get along on some things, right? He continues, that's actually Bowie's argument. Had it not appeared in the New York Times, it wouldn't really be worth anything, he says, outside of Twitter. Bowie himself doesn't quite buy it, conceding in his closing paragraph that he hasn't really made his case. Quote, you can make the case that none of this has anything to do with slavery and slaveholder ideology. You could argue that it has nothing to do with race at all, that it's simply an aggressive effort to secure conservative victories. Well, gee, yeah. In fact, that's the exact same thing Calhoun would say about what's going on in America today. You see, you've got the Republicans in power, sort of, in the Congress, because they control the Senate, which they can block things, which is the whole point, because the Senate was supposed to be the representatives of the states, and Republicans control more states, right? So they're able to do that. The House is trying to push this massively leftist agenda, which is entirely unconstitutional. It's not that the Senate is doing anything to preserve the Constitution either. The recent budget shows that. And then you've got the executive branch, which is supposed to uphold and defend the Constitution, which Donald Trump does not always do a good job of that either. But this is all about power, and it's what Calhoun said would happen. And I'll get into that in a minute. But why ascribe ordinary political motives when you can contort history to support an accusation of racism and slaveholder ideology? Consider Bowie's treatment of Calhoun, a figure the left desperately wants to associate with Republicans, but whose legacy is alive today nowhere so much as in the far left wing of the Democrat Party. This is where Davidson goes completely off the rails, at least sort of. Okay, now, he is correct that the Democrat Party does rely on minorities, and Calhoun's biggest complaint with American government is that minorities were not protected. That the whole point of constitutional government was to protect minorities from majorities. Now, isn't that the point of the Electoral College? Absolutely. Isn't that the point of the Senate? Absolutely. It was to protect minorities, whether it was not groups per se, or individuals, I should say, but sections or states, more importantly, because states were the building block of the entire system. So it was there to protect minorities from majority rule, from the tyranny of the majority. This is something that the founding generation talked about. They said they hoped democracy would die with the Constitution. So Calhoun was actually espousing what the founders wanted the Constitution to do. They didn't like democracy. They didn't like the idea of a tyranny of the majority. It was something that they wanted to kill with the Constitution. Now, I know he's not part of the founding generation. He's the second generation. But John Randolph of Roanoke was very open about this. There was look, that Virginia Constitution, I'm going to do a podcast on that because it's so good. The Virginia Constitution of 1829-1830 was that situation. Why do we want to invite more democracy when more democracy destroys everything? Bowie either ignores or is unaware of how Calhoun's political thought sharply deviates from that of the American founders. That's simply not true. But then he says, well, this is where he exposes. The political philosopher Harry Jaffa has explained in some detail how Calhoun's doctrine of the concurrent majority was designed to undermine the philosophical basis for American constitutionalism and replace it with a theory based on the faddish science of Darwinism and race theory. No, it wasn't. That's not what it was doing at all. The idea was to protect minorities from oppressive power. And he recognized the South by the middle of the 19th century was going to be put in a position of a conscious minority and that it should have some protection from the majority. Just as New England should have some protection from the South if it dominated. This is something John Taylor of Caroline brought up. John Taylor of Caroline, who was one of the founders, he said, look, we shouldn't destroy New England just because we have control of the government. Just as New England shouldn't destroy us. New England sectionalism in the 19th century, when they were running around talking about secession, which they were in 1812, they were talking about it in 1815, they were talking about it in 1803, they were talking about it in 1801, they were talking about it in 1800, they were talking about it in 1794, they were talking about it several times. The abolitionists were talking about it in the 1840s. I mean, what's the difference? They're all talking about it, and they were conscious of the fact that they believed they were a minority because they didn't think after the Louisiana Purchase they would ever have any power in this government. Then they came up with an idea. Oh, bing, light bulb goes off. You know what we can do? We can use the slavery issue to divide the West and the South. We'll get the West on our side, and then we'll control the government. The South will be the minority. So then the South started talking about secession at that point. You see, it's all about power. Who's going to control the government? And the North was not interested in abolishing slavery. Not in the South. Heck, they were making a ton of money on it. Why would they want to do that? Why would they even want to abolish the slave trade? Because they were making a lot of money on it. And there was actually some discussion about that. George Mason pointed it out. Why are you leaving that open? That's barbaric. You're damaging the domestic institution, which in his mind wasn't as bad, but the slave trade is barbaric. Why are we leaving this thing open? Why? Because New Englanders can make a lot of money on it. The largest slave trader in South Carolina, Nathaniel Russell, was actually from Rhode Island, right? So he had contacts because most of the slaves actually were transported into Rhode Island, Bristol, Rhode Island, and Newport, Rhode Island, during the height of the slave trade. As early as the 1820s, Calhoun was trying to correct what he saw as a monumental error by the founders. To Calhoun, it was folly to base the Republic on universal ideals, like all men are created equal. Nobody ever based it on that. This is ridiculous. There was a radical fringe group in America that would run around saying these things. They're the abolitionists. And you know who was denouncing that in the 1820s? New England clergymen. If you read Larry Tise's book, Pro-Slavery, he just lays it out for you. He says, look, you can't lay pro-slavery as the cause of the war. Everybody was talking about this, North and South. To Calhoun, it was folly-based Republican that, or to suppose that something like the Bill of Rights could protect the rights of a minority from the tyranny of the majority, which he was right. It's just a scrap of paper. You had to have something else. Because Calhoun pointed out the fundamental problem of American society, the constitutional system, was that when one group was out of power, they would talk about the Constitution constantly. You're violating the Constitution. You're doing things that are unconstitutional. You need to stop doing that. When the other side was in power, they would violate. And when they would flip, they would do the exact same thing. So he said there has to be some other check, some other break on the entire system. If we don't do that, we're going to create all kinds of problems for the future of America. This is why everyone should listen to Calhoun. He was concerned about power. Power. And the abuse of power by the central authority. I'm not going to get into what Jaffa says because it's ridiculous. Um, He says, in 1838, Calhoun openly broke with the founders on slavery, contending that many in the South once believed that slavery was a moral political evil. That folly and delusion are gone. We now see it now as the true light and regard it as the most safe and stable basis for institutions in the world. And then he says, Davidson says, the founding generation had never believed that. Really? Are you sure about that? In fact, the first pro-slavery treatise, and this is before the founding generation, was written in 1701 by a Massachusetts minister named John Saffin. And he said the exact same thing Calhoun just said there. There were people in the North who were saying these things. In fact, Calhoun's, not his mentor, but the leader of the curricula at Yale when Calhoun was there would say these exact same things. So, did Calhoun make this up? No. This is already circulating in the 19th century, in the 18th century, before Calhoun even said these things. Now, here's where Davidson also messes up when he quotes Jefferson incorrectly. He says, a year before that, in calling for the criminalization of the international slave trade, President Thomas Jefferson denounced slavery. No, he did not denounce slavery. He denounced the slave trade for its violations of human rights to which have been so long continued on the unoffending inhabitants of Africa, and when the morality, the reputation, the best interests of our country have long been eager to prescribe. He's talking about the slave trade, not slavery itself, not the domestic institution. If you read the paragraph from this, from his annual address, which was in 1806, this is what he's talking about. Of course, Jefferson, like other slaveholding founding fathers, applied the principles inconsistently. I mean, wait a second. You just denounced the 1619 Project for saying these things, and then you say the same thing. This is where the neoconservatives are lending a hand to the problem. Calhoun thought the Constitution was based on a lie. No, he didn't. He thought the Constitution was well-meaning, but it was problematic because it couldn't be enforced. The only way to do it was to come up with some way to enforce it. The 10th Amendment had no teeth, in other words. You had to have some way to enforce the Constitution. Bowie's ignorance of Calhoun's philosophical project helped explain the confusion of the founding. He makes passing reference to how the growth of the free Northwest threatened Southern dominance in Congress, but makes no mention of how the Northwest came to be. And no wonder, the relevant history here is a stumbling block. Congress passed the Northwest Ordinances in July of 1787, while the U.S. Constitution was still being drafted. The ordinance included a prohibition on slavery, but not in the territory, yes, but not in the states. And there was some discussion about having it in Illinois and Indiana, for example. And involuntary servitude in the new territory, the ordinance passed unanimously, which meant it enjoyed the support of Southern slaveholding members of Congress. This is true. Why? The question is why? Because they thought it would block the production of tobacco, for example, in this territory. And so the South would continue to have a monopoly on tobacco production. There were other political concerns here, too. They didn't think that these people would vote with the North. But there were other things that were going on there. It wasn't just about, you know, all right, we'll go with that because they won't have tobacco production there. Why would Southerners at the time of the founding support a prohibition on slavery on such a grand scale and at such an early stage in the new life of the founding republic? The left will answer that it was all a cynical ploy to prevent future northern states from becoming competitors in the cotton industry. No, they weren't worried about cotton. It was tobacco at this point. Cotton wasn't even thought of as a major cash crop in 1787. That came much later. A far better historical explanation is that from its founding, Americans really did believe in their principles and were actually acutely aware of the gulf between these principles and practice, above all, the practice of slavery. That's one reason more than one-third of the states between 1776 and 1800 abolished slavery, and even more of them, including southern states, restricted it. There was some discussion about this. Now, this took time. In fact, there's a website entitled Slave North. If you just look up Slave North, it's a collection of all the Northerners who did not really believe in abolishing slavery. In fact, New Jersey still had it at the end of the war. That's also why Calhoun, a generation later, had to construct an entirely new political philosophy based on junk science and metaphysical determinism. This was not an entirely new political philosophy at all. I just mentioned, I mean, look, if you want to talk about nullification, nullification was used during the American War for Independence. Nullification was advocated by Jefferson and Madison. Maybe Calhoun's his position that one could nullify for the whole was unique, but this idea of the North believed in nullification, it's not new, and the positions that he had were not new either. Americans British Americans in the early 18th century were saying the exact same thing. And Northerners, as Northern states began to abolish slavery, were saying the exact same thing Calhoun was saying. Northern ministers primarily. In 1850, Calhoun famously predicted the coming war. But to quote Jaffa, quote, he did not see that the Union had an interest in human freedom that was different from its interest in commerce, manufacturers, or land. He did not see this because, although a patriot himself, there was no room in his theory of the human soul for love of country any more than for the love of justice. Jaffa is a moron. And if it wasn't for Emmy Bradford actually making anyone aware of Jaffa, no one would have even been aware of Jaffa, and Jaffa would not even be an interesting figure whatsoever. So, there's my takedown of the piece, my discussion of the 1619 Project. Again, I will not discuss it one more time because it is junk history, and it does not need any validation. So, hope you enjoyed this episode of The Brian McClanahan Show. I will see you next time.